Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, this is Stuart Roberts, founder of Haircuts for Homeless, and welcome to the Hear Me, See Me podcast. I'm going to be talking to people who are truly inspirational to me. Some you may have heard of, and some you haven't, but you really need to hear their story. Hello, this is Stuart from Hear Me, See Me podcast. Today I've got a wonderful person with me, Catherine Flay. She's the CEO of Restart Lives, and it's a particular charity that one of the many that Haircuts for Homeless attends and partners with, but got a real soft spot for this place. We go there on a Friday night. We'll talk about it more later, but it's one of those that's really odd because we get out of the station, we walk past Harrods and all these wonderful places, and then we arrive at a church and we go downstairs and there's like a queue of like 100 people who are just coming to get something to eat and some companionship, you know, and the disparity of the sort of class and that of everything, it really hits you hard on that one. So today I'm talking to Catherine. How are you, my dear?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for having me. And that was like a nice summary of the drop-in. And one of the reasons that it feels so important to us is just operating in that area where there's so much wealth, but there's a lot of homelessness in that area as well, isn't there? So it's like, it seems like quite a counterintuitive place to have a drop-in, but it's actually so important because so many people sleep rough in kind of West and West Central London. So yeah, great to be here, Stu. Thank you so much.
I mean, yeah, and I do say that. I say that to many people when I travel all around the UK and Ireland, and it is one of them that stands out purely by the sort of this the different scale of it, you know.
It's Porsches parked outside. And,
yeah. When we go past Harrods, they're walking out with bags that probably feed us the whole lot for that night.
I know, it's unbelievable.
You know, like, people work hard, they deserve nice things, that's fine. I always try and not make people feel guilty about it succeeding. But it just feels a bit odd on that one. I'm not sort of making any judgment.
I know. I know what you mean.
Strange, you know.
Yeah, can be. I mean, a lot of people from around there do support us, to be fair to them. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't moan too much.
A little bit.
Yeah, sometimes. Well, look, so people know you. We'll talk a bit later about the about Restart Lives, but so people know you. Where were you brought up? What was your upbringing like?
So my upbringing was a little bit chaotic, you would say. I was born in Finland, so I wasn't born in the UK, but my dad's British, my mum's Swiss, and he was over there for work. And it was like, you know, we were one of those families. I was born in the 80s, like at the end of the 80s. And I think like lots of families in the 80s, it was like a time when people were really struggling to find work, like lots of industries massively disrupted by, you know, government policies, cultural change, social change. And my family was like that. You know, my dad's career was like massively disrupted. And my mum had already had an upbringing that was a little bit disrupted as well. So like not got where she should have done with education, you know, leaving school early as well. So like the way her career was going, you know, it like not as many opportunities at that time. So they were really struggling with everything that goes with that. So the financial side of that, the emotional side of that. We would travel around like different cities, different countries, trying to, you know, with my dad trying to build up a career and everything. And that was like really tricky at the time. So we experienced some of the stuff that some of our guests experienced. Like you know, for example, my parents never bought a home. Like lots of people have that experience of, you know, struggling with a mortgage. We didn't even get to that point. We would stay with people or stay in, you know, short-term accommodation, stuff like that. Always, you know, months of the year, stay with one grandparent or the other or family member. So that was kind of like my upbringing for a long time. And then I think I was one of those people, again, like lots of people with that type of background will probably relate to this, where like education just became massively important for me. I got the opportunity to go to a really good primary school, and I was starting school like a lot later than kids in the UK start school because it's different in some of the countries I was at. So I, like, at first I was a little bit behind and a little bit shocked by coming, you know, by being in that environment. But then, like, I just really took to it, and I loved education, and I realized I was quite good at it. And I just, like, progressed through, and I went to grammar school, and I ended up going to Cambridge University, which was obviously like an amazing opportunity, and going on to do a PhD. So I was, like, massively supported by my family, but also, like, having a, like, huge life-changing opportunity of education, basically. And then I just kind of, like, went on in a career that might be expected after that. And I didn't really reflect back on my upbringing, like, in the light that I'm presenting it in now. And I think, again, that's really common. Like, my parents didn't either. Like, once you're doing a little bit better and things become a bit more stable, you don't necessarily want to reflect back all the time on, like, what was tough or what you went through, or you don't want to conceptualize it in that way. So it wasn't until, like, later on when maybe I started having conversations with my parents about it, or, like, just thinking myself, or maybe even, like, having some type of, you know, therapy and having conversations about it, that I realized, like, oh, that's probably had quite a big effect. And that is what kind of, like, brought me back around to thinking about, you know, the issues of homelessness, the issues of precarious low wages, the issues of work instability, the issues of mental health that can compound all of that. Just, you know, all the tension that puts on a family. So that kind of, like, was a sort of personal journey that I went on. And then I ended up changing my career and coming to work in homelessness in the charity sector. So that's kind of, like, the long and short of my upbringing, and even how I kind of got to where I am now.
Fascinating. It always fascinates me, because generally it always ends up being something like this. Because everyone who works in the sector we're in, there's that why. Everyone's got that why. And it's important. This is why I do on the podcast, because I think we need to know someone's why. And you know, that's why it sounds a bit cliched. Oh, where was you born? What was you up to?
Yeah. But
it always really gets a real sense of purpose behind it. Just before you went over to this sector, where was you working? Not, like, particularly the place itself, but what sector were you in at that point?
So I worked for a little while in academia. So I taught at Birkbeck at London University, and I taught at Cambridge University for a little bit. And I was teaching, like, literature, politics, culture. And, like, you know, education has a massive social impact too. I did enjoy, especially working at Birkbeck, where a lot of people are in education, not from a direct route. Again, like, there's not necessarily as much privilege that goes with it. Like, I really enjoyed the social impact of that. And, you know, Cambridge, if you're intelligent and you like learning, like, you do meet incredibly intelligent people, then you've got so much access. That was brilliant. But, you know, academia is quite its own little world, like, its own bubble. If you're really passionate about making a change in the world, or you know, being part of, like, policy, politics, social impact, you may not stay in academia. So that's what I ended up doing. And then I was working at an institute, which was, again, around, like, getting access to big ideas, like making philosophy, or making, you know, like, the more complex ideas behind policies that affect everybody, or the more complex ideas behind the news, accessible to more people, like running events or running festivals or online resources and things like that. So I ended up, you know, senior at that company, kind of running that company under the guy who founded it. Yeah. And I was there for 5 years. But then, you know, that was all kind of leading me back to, I guess, the cause that I'm most passionate about.
Yeah. And it's what made you take that final jump?
I think it was just, it was, like, very much part of, like, a personal journey, if you want to call it that, that I was on, you know, like I say, reflecting on my own upbringing and like what had actually caused, you know, maybe some of the difficulties that I found myself experiencing, like, although I was doing really well, in a way in life, like, you know, thinking, oh, like, why does it seem like my peers don't get affected by this or that? And I feel like I do. So kind of like delving a little bit deeper into kind of like recognizing what it was that was affecting me and my own journey and my own relationship with, you know, all of the things that I described, basically, that made me think, God, so, you know, I could share that insight, or I could, you know, other people could benefit from my sort of empathy and understanding, but also the kind of business know-how that I've got now, and the sort of leadership skills that maybe I've got now, and the education that I've got now, I'd like to give it back, and hopefully other people could have, you know, success stories as well.
I think I'm not flattering. I don't really flatter too much, but I think they're lucky to have you, because
as a
CEO of the charity that I really understand, because I've worked alongside it quite for a long time, that someone like you is crucial as a CEO of having lived experience, also the sort of academic knowledge you've got that you can bring to it, and then the business side. Shame I'm not well educated. I could have said this a lot better, but you know what I mean. It's like you've got all of those things that lead the, you know, if I sort of jumbled them up, you make the perfect role as the CEO for that particular charity.
Yeah, that's so nice of you to say. And actually, like, there are, you know, everybody who has like any type of lived experience, there's always gaps in it. So, like, having said that, I've grown up around like some of those issues, I obviously haven't been, you know, a 40-year-old male white rough sleeper. So I don't have the perfect, you know, no one's got every type of story, do they? So it's just kind of having that empathy and awareness that I think you get when you've been around it, that I do think helps. But I think like what I was really keen to do when I started was like bring my skills that I feel like I've got and bring my experience that I feel like I've got, but also be like totally open to hearing, you know, the everybody who's been involved in the charity, because the charity's been running quite a long time, not in the most like organized way, and, you know, sometimes with loads of services, sometimes with not that many. You'll know because you've been working alongside it. So there were just so many people who'd like stuck it out through thick and thin with the charity. So I did feel like I had a lot to offer, but I also, the culture here is just so positive, kind of loyal. There's so much built-in knowledge that I was just like really lucky to be able to learn from, basically.
Well, the thing is, traveling around working alongside so many different types of charities, we get a different feeling about a lot of the ones we come across. And there's ones we really like to work with. Restart one of those, and there's many more, you know, In Hope in Bristol. There's lots of different ones. The new one in Watford. They were really great to work with. I didn't actually know I was going to speak about this, but it's brought me onto it. It's quite an interesting subject about money. Now, I'm not going to ask you anything about, I'll be delicate about it. But the thing is, it does come up a lot in conversations with big charities. And I'll be straight. We've been really used by some of the very big charities.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, you get to a point where you keep getting emails of a certain charity saying, can you come here? Can you come there? I mean, they all begin with that sort of, we haven't got any funds, but can we, you know, be there and everywhere. And we struggle a lot in getting funds in such a small charity like that.
It's
really tough. And then, so sometimes when you keep seeing this, and it's made me look at some of the two in particular that we try not to work with now. And when you see having like 16, 20 million in the previous year, when you see that the CEO is on nearly £200,000 a year, when the board are on £1 million between them, And then they say that they've got no funds. You know, I'm loath to ask my volunteers to go and volunteer their time free of charge.
Yeah.
Easily enough money to hire a freelance hairdresser to come along, you know, like, and it's, but then, you know, then when I sometimes speak to people, and I've got friends in the business world, and I say, well, you know, they're working for a charity, why do they need to earn all that? But they say, well, they might be able to earn 300,000 in a different charity. So they're only, you know, it depends.
But, yeah, it is all relative. Yeah,
it is relative. And so I take it that, you know, I take the point that sometimes if someone's that qualified, and you've just sat and explained everything about what you bring to that role, and I would think that, you know, whatever it is, and I'm not, whoever it is, it's well, you were, you know what I mean? But when there is some, and you know, and I've been to some of these places, and it's not authentic as Restart is. It's not as authentic as In Hope in Bristol. They're not. It's very corporate, and I'm sure they do a lot of good, but it just sometimes it rubs me up the wrong way a little bit.
I totally get that. I mean, you'll know we're a tiny little charity, really, compared to some others. We're growing at the minute, and you know that does mean taking on more paid staff, which is great because we want to have those skills in house and we want to put the funds behind paying for them.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do sometimes see charities operating with huge budgets, and the way they work with volunteers, you know, it can be a bit sketchy with work with versus use volunteers. You know, it's a tricky one. I don't know about that, because obviously I don't. our budget isn't like that. And who knows what I'd be like if I had a budget of that size? Maybe it's hard to, you know, delegate the funds, or maybe it's a sort of corporate strategy coming into the charity sector. I don't know, but yeah, we definitely we rely on people like you who have their own organisation and are willing to kind of lend their time to us, give their time to our guests. So. Yeah, it is. It's a good kind of working relationship we have with most of our volunteers, I would say.
Yeah, you can. It comes across as well. I mean, it's like we gladly partner with all of. We can't do it without it, because if we can't partner with a centre that's already caring for guests, we are a bolt on. We sort of add on to that. You know, we're a cooker. We come along and add on.
Yeah,
got the funds or the facilities to set up any premises anywhere, but it's what makes us very economical, because we haven't got the big outlay.
Would you really benefit from having that? I feel like some of what guests get, obviously they get the haircut and they get like the enjoyment on that day, the positive, you know, boost for their confidence, chat with you, the chat with your other barbers, hairdressers who you bring along. But it's also like they look forward to it. It's genuinely something that people, you know, if they're meeting their basic needs, I hear what you're saying, that obviously if people are really like at a low point where and they're not getting supported by an organisation, it wouldn't be the same. But, you know, when they're having casework, when they're part of programmes, when they're coming to the drop-in and you know, feeling like sort of cared for in that space anyway, they're always asking when's the next time haircuts coming in. And it's a boost for them to even think about it and plan it into their diary sometimes, I think. It's in a way, if you had your own space and you weren't coming out into, you know, the various communities, it would probably be quite different.
Yeah, and that's to be honest, you've hit the nail on the head. And this is why, I mean, we've been turned down for the last 3 years from the National Lottery for the big reaching community.
It's amazing what they turn down.
Especially since I was on the bloody advert. So I was on the lottery advert, you know what I mean? And you think like, but that, so trust
like,
me,
really?
People think it gave me an automatic in with the lottery, but you know, you're still going to get turned down. But I do understand.
It's strange,
With the guy, I said, look, I've got to have a meeting, and we had a Zoom, and he explained it, and he said, well, you're sort of too small for this big. Grant, but you're too big for the small. I said, well, you need a medium, don't you? And he said, well, we may be working on that. And I thought, well, we'll see.
But we'll see,
And he said to me as well, like, he said, I think if you started to fill all the criteria of reaching the big community stage, you'd lose the authenticity of what you are and what you do, because then you'd be a bit tired, you know. Whereas we have got a lot of freedom about where we go and, you know.
Yeah, I think like that's something that I love about Restart and the size of it. You know, we are growing, so we supported more people last year than we have done before. We've got 2 new caseworkers. We've got a program exec on board as well. So we've got more staff and we're doing more. But I don't want us to grow, you know, necessarily beyond that point where we can be really flexible. Because I see it with you as well. Like, we've had guests who've actually wanted to get into hairdressing or becoming barbers. And you kind of, because you're not a really big, really bureaucratic organization, you're there on the ground and they can have a chat with you. And you, you know, you don't mind exchanging your business details with them and let that, you know, give them a bit of a way in. It's not part of some like specific program you're doing and you don't have to run it past a million people. You're able to be quite agile with, you know, offering extra extra things here and there that make sense when you're on the ground doing your service. I think we're the same. And that's like a massive sort of advantage that you have when you're kind of the size of a smaller or medium organization.
Yeah. I think we would like to grow some though, purely to the fact that everything's done by me and my sister. So, you know, like bonus. And I think we're a victim if we look too good because we sort of look like a big charity and they say, oh, can we speak to your marketing department? And I say, yeah, yes, that's me. And, you know, it's everything. Yeah. So
I do know what
people on to do some of these roles. So we will get there.
Yeah. And I think like that's definitely like something that I looked to do when I came into this role. Cause I was like, let's take the best of Restart and what it's doing now. Like it's very, you know, personal. People who know Restart love Restart. It's a very like personal and genuine relationship that the charity has with the people it supports, the community around it, the volunteers, etc. You know, let's keep all of that and the agility and the flexibility. But let's just like, you know, put the right systems in place in the background so we're collecting data. I mean, that's been a massive thing for us as well as, you know, up in the services, just kind of slightly moving towards that more kind of slick back end operation of the charity, because then, you know, it's all we need that really to know what impact are our interventions having. And I mean, I'm doing the reporting at the minute and it's just so interesting to actually learn.
Yeah.
It's not always, you know, when you're there on the ground dealing with it case by case, the patterns aren't always evident. And if you don't have the data, you also can't do any of that influencing work. Like we could share what we found with the local MPs where we operate or with, you know, local councils as well. Or I joined in the Homeless Link parliamentary lobbying day the other day, and you can kind of join things like that with a bit more authority because we know the issues that are bad. We know kind of at an anecdotal or like personal level what's going on for the people who we support and who we chat to, but you know that doesn't work when you're speaking to funders that well. Like case studies do, but you know you need to build them into that. But what funders really want and what makes a difference at the heart of power is, you know, the data on it, like how many people are experiencing what and what actually works. And so that's been something we've focused on massively, which I hope is making a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I know the power of that. I mean, one of our sort of head trustee is Millie Kendall, OBE,
who runs
British Beauty Council, and she, you know, she's an amazing woman.
That's
what they've done with the British Beauty Council. You know, they've got the stats, they've got the data, enough to take it to government, you know. And
exactly.
So I've seen the power of it, and it's just a bit like chicken and egg with us. You know, we haven't got the infrastructure in place to get all of that, but we need to somehow do it. We're 10 years this year, and I think we've done well to keep going for 10 years, and we've done well to get back to where we dipped from during the pandemic, get back there. But I think the target for the next 10 years is to just grow enough, you know, and as you've said, just want to grow enough so that we can start collating all that data, have 3 or 4 people, paid employees, to do the stuff that me and Blinda, because we end up feeling that we're letting everyone down. I know
that feeling, yeah.
You know that feeling when you think, oh, we're letting down because I'm not doing well enough on my social media and I'm not,
yeah,
everyone's watching EastEnders, I'm on my Instagram doing the, you know, and you can't go on and grow like that. You need people, someone of each slot to do that, you know.
Yeah, it's really hard as well. Like I was saying, we get amazing support from, you know, the community around us in Knightsbridge. So we're over in Knightsbridge. We're also in Tower Hamlets and Hackney, but like the big drop-in is over there in West Central. And you know, that community is incredibly generous to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're used to, you know, being treated like VIPs, and they are VIPs, and they are VIPs to us as well. But, you know, carving out that time to thank people enough and make them feel appreciated is so difficult when it's like that is competing with, you know, someone about to be evicted, and we're all hands on deck with that because we are a small team. So, yeah, I know that feeling of like thinking, am I letting someone down here, and balancing everybody who's important is like, it's so many plates spinning. It's one of the hardest things probably.
Yeah, because
it is, isn't it?
I get this anxiety as well as if you have taken people for granted. I don't like to be taken for granted. And
I know.
Sometimes that people have helped us and they think, I haven't got back to that person. And you just constantly state the anxiety of not
it is, isn't it?
Enough.
And then sometimes you think like, gosh, they probably think they weren't important, but actually they were so important because they made that donation at a key time and we actually just ran with it straight away and did something impactful. But we couldn't tell them, you know, we didn't take the time to chat about that or take them out for a coffee or, you know, so like we would like to do. Those are the things I think where if you're a larger organization, you can be so much like slicker, can't you, with your comms and with your relationship management and everything like that. And we're just a little bit like, here's a card to say thank you. I hope that's enough. You know, it's not a bottle of champagne or whatever. Yeah.
I don't even answer the text, you know.
sometimes, exactly.
Like, oh my God. Anyone watching, if you've helped us and I'm not thankful,
we are really grateful.
I'm like a goldfish. I just, as I come round the bowl again, it's all gone and I've got, you know, like constantly.
It can be quite overwhelming though. Yeah. Like, do you and your team, because it's a funny one for you because you're working like you and your team.
Yeah, me and Blinky,
you too, but also your volunteers as well, because they are so part of your team, aren't they, when they come out and about?
Of course.
Do you find that, like, do you actually experience like the same, obviously there's like the business side stresses and strains of it, but do you experience that kind of emotional kind of drain from working on the front line? Like, do you hear things that can be quite like, they stay with you, you're lying in bed at night thinking like, God, I'm worried about that person? And
of course, we're very conscious of the fact that our team leaders carry a great burden.
So
it's all around the country, you know. Like the two girls have just set up in Watford, you know, that it's such a hands-on personal experience, with particularly with the way we do it. We're in someone's space, you know, we're in this personal space, and I don't know if it's energy or something, but you do take, I don't know. But
you do, I know what you mean,
You sort of take it all in. At one point we did provide, we had a little bit of funding there, and we provided one of our team members with therapy. But we constantly... The wonderful thing about WhatsApp, you know, we've got WhatsApps for every team.
Yeah.
The Dublin one is hilarious and and filthy, you know, I must say. But it's funny as anything. And they're all so different, you know, like around the country with these WhatsApps. But that's why you can never get me on the phone, because I have to have it on silent, because it'd be pinging on all these WhatsApps.
Oh, my gosh, I'm the same, yeah. It means
that we can keep in contact with all of these projects, the team leaders, and then the team leaders sometimes private message me and Blinda with something that they don't want to share with the whole group and worry them. In fact, straight away, I'm thinking I was supposed to ring one of them last night and I didn't get around.
Oh, no, don't you get stressed now.
I'll ring them after. We've done it. You've woken up in the middle of the night and you've got enough to worry about your family, but you are worrying about someone who you've come across, you know, and you get really close to people. There's homeless people that I have been known now for 10 years, for nearly the whole 10 years, the early projects. I'm still, and unfortunately, they're still in that position. You know, I think Dwayne Ilford that I know straight away, and, you know, But we've got to know a lot of your guests, you know, as well.
Yeah, you do.
We walk
you
in.
Do.
And you know, and it's like your regulars if you had a barbershop, you know.
It is, 100%. And especially on your weeks, it's the same people who turn up early to be front of the queue because they want to get their hair cut. That you do definitely have regulars, yeah. Or even, because, I mean, we support people once they've moved on from homelessness to, like, sustain the positive changes. So some of the people, it's not too bad if you still see them at our drop-in because maybe they are in housing. Maybe they're, you know, taking those steps. But I do know what you mean as well. Like, we've got, you know, I think it was last year we hit our 1,000 guest at the drop-in. And now we've got, you know, quite a few over that. But some of the people from those early numbers, because we have like a register and people sign in and they've got their special restart membership number. Some of those really early numbers, you know, ones, twos, threes, they're still coming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's definitely testament to the fact that it can be really like ongoing for people. Or we see a lot of people, we think when we don't see them then for a few months, we think, I wonder if they're doing better or if they're doing worse.
Yeah,
because you do get to know people, but not everybody we don't do casework with everybody.
Yeah.
We don't have, you know, we see them when they want to turn up and share something with us, but we don't have their contact details. We don't have a reason to be in touch with them. So we can't even ask sometimes if we don't see someone, we just have to accept it. And that can be quite stressful, I think, as well. Yeah. Wondering, like, I hope the best, but it could be worse than that.
There's a guy there who was there. I won't say him or describe him, but there was a guy who was there Friday who we haven't seen for a couple of visits.
I know. I think
I'd ask some of the others and say, "Is he all right?" Yeah. Something, and he was this more subdued self this time, but it was lovely to see him. And then, because you do think the worst, you know. And we have lost people. We've lost so many people.
I know.
It's the mortality rate of street homeless. You know, we went to this, we've done this sleep out in Manchester and there was an artist there and they'd researched it and it takes 36 years off a female's life.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's incredible to me because it meant like, to just bring it to, if you're going to live to your 80, you're going at 44.
And I think that is the average age, isn't it? In your 40s,
early
50s to pass away if you're rough sleeping, if you're homeless, that's the age.
Long-term rough sleeping, it's purely, it just brings it wears you down, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, even if it wasn't for like the physical side of it, just the emotional side, like we've got this partnership with Minds, the mental health charity.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do like stuff for our team, you know, including like support around well-being, but also like massive upskilling training and mental health support and just like being trauma informed in everything we do. But part of their trait, and we're doing the one-to-one therapy for our guests as well, but part of the training was just learning about certain experiences or like an index of trauma. And if you've experienced, say, I can't actually remember what the number was, but say it was like people who experienced, you know, three or more of these things out of 10 as a child have a life expectancy, you know, considerably shorter than an average person's life expectancy. So even just the mental health side of it, you know, it's huge. And we did I was really reflecting on that over kind of Christmas time. Cause you know, did you know we did our big sleep out December the 1st? Cause you were there doing haircuts that night, I think. And then we stayed on and it was our sleep out event. Yeah.
I shot straight off. I'm nice, but I'm not that nice.
No, you are. To be fair, like it is not for people like you to make that extra commitment, but it was crazy that night. It was -4. Like we haven't had such a cold night since the coldest night. So, you know, that was our big fundraising, awareness raising event. Yeah. Lots of staff, a few trustees, supporters from the community sleeping out and raising money for us as well. But I was just really reflecting on, it was so cold. It was so uncomfortable. I felt we had security guards and a road closed. It still felt vulnerable. People who didn't know we were doing an event just saw a load of sleeping bags in the street. Some of them were being abusive, critical.
Yeah.
Some of them, you could just hear their comments, even if they weren't addressing it to us. Some, you know, you felt a bit, you felt vulnerable, you felt under threat, and it wasn't even anything like the real condition. And that's just like, you know, we experienced the physical side of it. We knew we were going home for a hot shower. We knew we were having a nice breakfast inside. We knew we had this community. We were doing it for a good reason. We felt good about it. But if you were going through that physical side of it, night after night, plus the mental, it's absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah.
I think people lose sight of that. You know, there was all that stuff in the news, Suella Braverman saying, oh, it's a lifestyle choice. You know, when you hear things like that, I think, like, I try to be a respectful person. So I'm like, okay, that's a politician. They're in authority. Let me try to take at face value what they've said. So I was testing it on myself. I was like, is there any situation in which I would make that lifestyle choice? Is there a situation in which I would like to give up a home, warm or not, with heating bills? You know, even with the heating off, it's a home. My stuff, because you can't carry much around. So even if you don't have much, you'd be giving. No, there's no way. I'm never, ever making that lifestyle choice. You know, I'd have to be forced it. And I'd try to ask other people, like friends, family, guys, is there anyone?
Yeah.
You know, that relates to this comment that would make that choice. I didn't find a single person. I just don't know. Did anyone like, was there this like massive support for that? People being like, oh yeah, I made that choice. I didn't hear anybody, you know, no one would. And no one said they had made that. It was odd.
You're a lot nicer than me. So I didn't do any of that justification. I just went straight in, called or whatever I posted. But, you know, it's true. You should look at it and you should think, you know, what is the reasoning? But then you were always going to come up negative on that one because it was such out of touch statement. And what my sort of thing, because you get a lot of people, so many judgmental people and so many, you know, like, are they all deserving and this, that and the other. And you know, what I always say to them is like, would you swap? That's straightforward thing. I've got it in my mind. Anyone starts saying anything, I go, well, would you swap? I don't say it aggressively. I just say, oh, would you swap? And you see him stop in their tracks. Because, you know, like, he's probably not even homeless. He's begging on the street and he probably earns a lot of money. But would you swap? Would you sit there for 6 hours on the
Do you want to then? Yeah, exactly.
You know? And it generally makes people, it just stops them thinking. That my best, I've said this so many times in the podcast on lots of other things, but it moved me so much. It was Brother Kevin who used to run, he's retired now, bless him. Yeah. He used to run the Capuchin Centre in Dublin. And he said to me that they serve up to 800 people a day. No, it's I'm hoping to go back at the end of this year. And he said that a lady come up in a car, kids in the car, and she come over to get some food and stuff. And he thought, well, why do you need it? So he stopped on the way out and he said to her, can I just ask you, if you've got a car and everything, why do you need to come and use us? And she said, well, she was really apologetic. I'm really sorry, Brother Kevin, but the last time my husband beat me, he beat me so bad I thought I was going to die. So I just put the kids in the car and we are now living in the car.
Crazy, the story. You can't judge.
Yeah. And he said, you never judge at that point. And, you know.
Yeah. We have the same, like, we've had guests who are, you know, they sound really well-to-do. Yeah, they look quite good. They're sleeping in their car. It's, you know, and they're trying to keep up the facade that their life is okay. Yeah. Maybe they even still have their job.
Yeah.
You know, it can be a sudden thing that someone loses their home. They don't lose all their stuff necessarily overnight.
Yeah.
And people will try to present. Some people end up presenting in a stereotypical homeless way, but, so, you know, what every person on this, on the, you know, average person will imagine a homeless person may look like. Some people do present like that, but some people are trying so hard not to appear homeless.
Yeah, I know.
Even, you know, like I said, we've collected quite good data this year. And it was like, you know, for example, we did casework with 136 people one-to-one. And of those, 30% were actually like the rough sleepers. They were rough sleeping. Other people might be hotels, hostels, whatever. But even then, when we're trying to help people, when we are an organization for homelessness, an understanding place, a safe space, we reckon that's an underestimation because people might not want to say.
Yeah.
So even to us, who exist to help people who are homeless, probably like the most understanding type of organization a homeless person could approach, there will be underreporting in how severe someone's situation is because people don't want to admit how bad it's got. So yeah, that's like such a good example, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And the pride that people do take in themselves, and this comes back to when we work. We sometimes, I'm quite taken aback by people's, willingness to sort of keep going and keep trying to be the best of themselves.
I completely agree.
Next month, thank God, I'm 18 years sober, but I often, and they're not, but this is where I have my relationship with, this is my niche with people that I really get when they're struggling, and I often have good chats with people when we're doing their hair about sort of drink and drugs and things, and I've got a good understanding. But sometimes they tell me their story, and I think, my God, no wonder you drink. I know it makes things worse, but you no wonder. And sometimes,
but I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, that was another thing that's been so helpful, like, for me on the mind training, because one of the things that's really noticeable is that people don't seem to always be acting in their best interest. Like, why would that person, once you're already in this situation, why would you start drinking, for example? That's not how humans work. We don't like go around like robots, like, what is my best next step? I'm going to take that. We get affected by stuff.
Yeah.
And we need an escape. We need a crutch. We need, it's quite inhuman to like judge people as if, when a lot has already happened to them, they should be making these healthy choices. That is so hard. You know, all of us don't do it. You have a hard day.
Yeah.
You know, the really sort of basic thing is you have a hard day, you might eat more junk food.
Yeah. Like,
imagine that times 100, times 1,000 is going to lead to unhealthy choices.
Of course.
Potentially, not everybody, but potentially,
It's been scientifically proven as well that people underperform when they're in stress mode.
Of course,
Now, people living on the street, homeless people, are in a constant 24-hour stress mode. You're not going to make choices. You know, I know from experience that the only way to be sober is be 100% sober. There's no playing around.
What can you do?
Abstinence is everything if you suffer from what we suffer from. However, it'll be like, well, I'm going to put the drugs down, but I've got to have a drink to warm myself up, or I'll take my head away.
Yeah.
But once you're under that influence, then someone comes along with a little bit of crack or something, and they're going to go, oh yeah, far away, because it's thing. You get this where someone explained to me really well about it once for that situation when you see these programs of people on a very low income, but they've got the great big tellies, but. It was explained to me that because they're in a constant state of stress, they're not going to think long term on things. It's the short term solution. It's like, well, let's make
that self-soothing.
Let's get the telly for the kids and that, even though it's not the best decision. So you can't really judge. We're a judging species.
But it's also like, we do, of course. And like, it's fair enough, I think, to look at something and wonder why. That's interest. And actually, I think that can be good. But as long as you approach it also with empathy and with knowledge, like, that is the most important thing. Like, back to Suella Braverman's comments, just look at all the research on homelessness and the leading causes, lifestyle choices and out there. So as long as you want, if you have a gut instinct about something, go look into it if it's an important thing, or if it's about judging someone else, have a chat with them, look into it in research or whatever. It's probably not the best idea to just look at something and make a snap decision and go around spreading that.
Yeah, I've learned so much over these 10 years. My as a human being, I'm so different now than I was 10 years ago. And purely, not, it's just purely by being amongst it, you know.
Yeah.
I was very shocked at early. I thought I was such a lovely bloke. But I had so many
I'm sure you were.
No. But I had so many preconceived ideas and so many, and you can't get into this world without realising it's so different. You know, it's just people with bad luck, good people with bad conditions.
Well, but it also, don't you think, like, I reflect the other way as well, because I've actually learned a lot about resilience, about still being, you know, about sticking to your values, even in a tough situation, about manners. You know, I have learned so much from the guests who we support as well, because especially, for example, going to the drop-in around the back of Harrods, you know, people might bump into you in the street. They might not be polite. You might, you know, there's loads of sort of experiences you can have where you think you've experienced someone's bad manners. And those might be people who have every opportunity in life to be the best person they could be and all the time in the world to spend on, you know, being polite and all the headspace as well, because maybe they've got lots of leisure time or whatever, and they still don't do it. Whereas our guests, who might sleep outside night after night, all of the stress that you've already described that they might be experiencing, they come in and say, hello, how are you?
Yeah.
Haven't seen you for a week. How have you been? You know, thank you, please and thank you for their cup of tea. Would it be okay if I had a drop more milk in there?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what a lesson to learn that whatever situation you're in, please and thank you can't hurt you, you know. And there's more to it than that. But even the little things, I'm just sometimes, I remind myself when I'm like pushing onto the tube with a bit of a get out my way attitude. I'm like, come on, be a bit of a nicer person. Life's too short.
I've often got F off written right across my forehead when I'm...
I have, like, of course, because I get stressed as well. I'm sometimes, like, I was saying to my friend the other day, sometimes I'm insane to this, I'm like, oh, I'm terribly sorry, could I just get past you to this? And I'm actually thinking, like, get away, enraged with people. So, you know, it's not like I've learnt the lesson, I'm perfect now. But, there's a lot to be understood and empathetic about, but there's a lot to learn as well, for sure.
I know one thing that I always, particularly at Restart Lives and many of the other ones I go to, often I don't want to go because often I've been busy all day and then I've got to then get this. It's a bit of a nightmare journey on the tubes for that one,
isn't it? Especially when like Winter Wonderland's on in the winter. It's like, oh, no thanks.
And then, you know, and I get there and then I sort of light up as I start to burn and it's so busy and everyone's...
I know what you mean.
And I come out of there and generally I'm tired, but I'm happy.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. And for 2 hours, I forget all of my stuff and I'm just concentrating on my guests. And, you know, it's the most selfish thing I do. Because I think I feel the same
as well. Like, I used to think, oh my gosh, it's on a Friday night. It's every Friday night. What am I going to do? I'm going to miss going to the pub, or I'm going to miss going around to my friend's house or going to this party. Well, that, I don't miss it at all. No offense to my friends. You know, it is a community and it's something, it feels enjoyable to do. Either, you know, it's not a barrel of laughs every time, but it feels worthwhile, it feels good, and the human connection there is very real, which it isn't always in normal life, is it?
Well, to be honest, I don't think we can finish on a better thing. It's that we really, you know, I think it's been a good advert for coming and helping us, you know, because we need volunteers. You need volunteers.
We do, we'd love it. We always love to meet new people.
I think we've summed up really what a great thing it is to do, you know, and the wonderful people you meet. I mean, I just love it at that place, you know.
We love having you as well. We wouldn't be Restart really without you guys coming in there every 6 weeks doing what you do. It's so part of us as well now.
We so enjoy it. But, you know, so what's the future now? What's your, I mean, What's your, just before we wrap up, what's your sort of plans for the next 3 to 5 years? What would you like
to... this year we're getting into a little bit into that researching and influencing space. We've got a general election coming up and we want our knowledge to count in that. So I won't go into it too much, but, you know, we're launching a new program around that to help get guests engaged in politics as well, give them the confidence, the skills to advocate a little bit for themselves and speak up, and also, you know, share what we know with government. So we've got a big new program around that. Lots more online resources, because we know we want other services to benefit from what we do. And otherwise, we're going to be keeping up the casework numbers, hoping to do more than 30 a quarter, you know, take on new cases more than 30 a quarter again. We'd love to, you know, we served over 14,000 meals last year. We want to do it again. We want to do more. So more of the same, but with a little bit of that focus on actually changing policy, hopefully, because we can put on sticking plasters and do our very best, but there is some structural change that's needed as well.
I can't wait to hear more about it.
We'll tell you.
Thank you so much for sparing me the time at your busy schedule.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll put all the links on. People will see all the links to Restart Lives and stuff like
that. Amazing. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. You take care, Stu. See you very soon. You take care. Bye.